Welcome to the FinTech Scaly Show. This podcast is sponsored by Scale Up Consulting, helping FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@scaleupconsulting.co. Now, over to the show with Richard Doherty, founder and host.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we're very excited to have Steve, CEO of Signatize. Prior to launching Signatize and getting off into the startup scene, Steve worked across financial services and held senior positions in from a consulting and also banking perspective over a number of years. So we're super pumped to have you on the show today, Steve, and talk through your journey. How are you doing?
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me. Quite excited about this little interview.
Cool. Let's jump into it. What I like to do at the start of the show is just to give our listeners a bit of background around the guest and how they entered into the world of fintech and the startup scene. So maybe to kick off, why don't we jump in and discuss, you know, maybe your background and also why you decided to move from sort of corporate banking consulting into that startup scene.
Okay. Yeah, I think I had almost like I've been lucky enough to have quite a natural progression and almost like a phased approach. So I started off working for banks within operations. And as my career progressed, I kind of changed from what they called run the bank into change the bank. And change the bank was kind of is transformation, operational change. So I kind of turned from a kind of more clerical and administrative into more of a kind of project manager. And then you become like a business analyst / project manager. And then that kind of evolved into being like an internal consultant. So the latter stages of my career working for banks, I was literally just plonked into places that areas, businesses, locations that would deem to be kind of broken or in dire need of improvement. So then I would kind of like do the analysis and advise on how to do things better. Of course, nearly always that involves technology. So I got very familiar with what we probably called then technology within finance and what we call now fintech. So I kind of got my corporate career, I guess, probably wasn't too suited to it. I was a bit of a yes man. So in some respects, it's like it can be quite controlling after doing that for 20 years. And it's like, I'd love to have a bit of my own kind of influence, be my own boss. So I left to do exactly the same thing, started up a limited company and went on a day rate. So after I'd had my first gig, I thought, hey, this is really cool. But in order to advise my customers, the banks, better, I need to understand all about this new innovative technology. So I kind of schooled myself, or, you know, went to meetups and lectures and stuff like that to understand more about it. And that's when I saw more opportunities kind of appear. And that's when I kind of bit the bullet and jumped foot on into startup scene.
Cool. And I mean, sounds like a very interesting journey. And how did, I guess, the start of it, those skills that you mentioned, fixing broken things, and then also going out to meetups and really understanding the ecosystem, how has that helped you on your path to being a successful sort of startup entrepreneur?
Yeah, it's an interesting game. So I think I've been really lucky. If I look at my first job I had, there really wasn't enough minutes in the day to do the job if you actually wanted to go home. So immediately you're just finding better ways of doing things. You have to, otherwise you'd never go home. So you start looking, I guess naturally I started turning into a process person. So you always question how things are done. It's like, oh, why do we do this? Why do we have to do that? Can we avoid doing it? Is it necessary? And then it kind of, yeah, you do things more efficiently. You automate what you can, you get interested. And I guess that was the next stage that got me into the kind of the change the bank thing. And then, of course, you're just building up a skill set. So that's transferable. So if an area was not performing or whatever, and it was like, oh, there isn't enough days to do this with enough hours in the day to do this with the resource you've got, can you go in and have a little look and advise how to do it better? So just then you kind of just switch into the consultant thing. Mm. And that is exactly what you do in a startup. You produce a project, a product or a service or something that basically helps people, that helps organizations. And obviously, if you commoditize it, then you sell it and that makes you money. And so...
And I mean, so you building a product, you mentioned building a product, and if the customers like it, obviously they buy it. But how did your business idea come about? Was it a wow moment, or was it more in that operational area that you found a real problem that you wanted to solve?
Another good question. I think I did it again, sort of slightly back to front. So when I started looking at the innovative technology, one of the things everyone was talking about was blockchain. So it was in all the papers. This is back end of 2015, beginning of 2016. Oh, it's going to revolutionize trading, clearing, and settlement. It's going to revolutionize everything. And banking will be run on blockchain and stuff. So I needed to find out what this blockchain thing was all about. When I did understand it properly and the penny dropped, I didn't necessarily believe what the claims people were making. I thought they were kind of outlandish. And in some respects, that gave me the confidence to actually then go, well, hang on a second. If I know that that's not true, but, you know, kind of put your money where your mouth is. It's like, why don't I actually do something that could be successful? It's an amazing technology. Mm. And there will be things that will have a decent enough business case to start a business and then get adoption. And then who knows where that might lead. It was very critical of the other things that people were doing, but then it's like, well, what would work? So I started speaking to friends, associates, etc., to get ideas from them. And I literally was kind of had a matrix of like all of the ideas and was kind of marking them about, you know, with on a 1 to 10 scale on how good they were, depending on a variety of parameters. Hmm. And then somebody, Sean Blake, said, how about the management and sharing of authorized signatories within banks and corporates and stuff? And I thought that was the genius thing. So like straight away, it's like, yeah, that's it. That's the thing with the biggest market that's relatively straightforward that solves a massive problem within banks and large organizations.
Yeah, and what is that problem that you guys are solving in banks and other big corporates?
So every, let's call them large organizations, or this is a fintech show, let's call the banks and large asset managers, yeah, etc. All of their employees will have a responsibility to do things on behalf of their organization, whether that's make a payment, sign a check, a bit outdated, sign a legal agreement, sign an NDA, can the cleaner sign an NDA. Each person has a certain responsibility of the levels of which, depending on their seniority and their role and the function, about what they can actually do on behalf of the organization. They're called authorized signatories or delegated authorities. Mm. So each of these organizations will keep registers of who can do what on behalf of the organization. So these registers are typically maintained on kind of Word documents or spreadsheets, and they have to be shared with all of their counterparts that they do business with. So if Bank A is doing business with Bank B, somebody in Bank A signs something, a term sheet or whatever, then in order for Bank B to be satisfied, they need to know that the person who signed it is all duly authorized to do so. So they'll want to see a record of that on a formal register. And that register is an authorized signatory list. However, because they're maintained on like Word documents and they're emailed out on like scanned copies with PDF attachments, nobody knows what version is, you know, what's the latest version, what's up to date. Usually by the time these registers have been compiled, they're out of date because somebody might have left the organization, somebody's been promoted, somebody's moved department. You have all these like firewall things to consider, and can that person do this and also do that, et cetera, et cetera. So they're really, really dynamic. But to keep your counterparts up to date, like real time, is impossible to do with like Word documents and emailing. So that's the problem that we solve.
Oh, so does, I mean, maybe you can provide a bit of a case study, because does it work inside a corporate and also obviously work to provide that information to external counterparts such as, you know, legal firms, etc.?
Yeah, that's kind of the whole point. So there's a, internally, there's like a centralization of all of the signatories and all of the different areas and locations and entities, et cetera, et cetera. If we, we look at one of our customers, they probably run 10,000 company entities. So they're going to have at least 10,000 signature lists. In some of the bigger entities, they're going to have lots and lots. So you can have all of your signatories in the database, and each of those signatories can be assigned different authorities depending on what area they're in or like what entity they represent, et cetera, et cetera. So that's really easy, but there's nothing that's not too much more exciting than any other standard database. Because we have a decentralized database, our customers have owned their own part of their database, and they can basically open that up on a read-only basis to whomever they choose for as long as they choose. So effectively is what they do. They can update all of these things really efficiently, real time. And anyone they've permission to view this data, the registers, they, you don't have to tell them. You don't have to send the information to them. There's no emailing. There's no posting. There's no printing. They just get a live view of what's going on.
And tell me, how did you guys, because it's quite a, I guess, a niche offering, right? I mean, it's, I don't know if there's any competitors in the space, if I'm really honest with you, but how did you guys approach, I guess, the branding side of things as you went to market and also as you started building the business out? So getting your name into clients and getting your name out there.
The hardest bit. We've got the least we've got the least sexiest product in the world in fintech. It's like there's nothing glamorous about like what we do.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I wanted to ask the question, because it's such a, well, although it's not sexy, it's it fulfills a need and actually fulfills quite a, it solves quite a huge problem. Because I mean, we've all been through it, right? Chasing after signatories and losing losing those documents, etc.
Yeah, I'm going to say that we probably haven't even got there yet with the branding. I mean, like everything is like definitely work in progress. However, in recent months, well, the recent years, the COVID, the lockdown, let's not say COVID helps us, I don't like saying that, but the lockdown scenarios definitely have helped us, because obviously with people in different locations, it makes the existing processes even harder to manage. And now the world is kind of looking at the whole ESG thing. So there's like a major focus on governance. So, and together with e-signatures as well. So we complement the use of e-signatures. So we're kind of, can I say, hanging off the coattails of like e-signatures or tools to enable remote working and aiding governance. I mean, I guess that's kind of the messages that, that we get across from, or trying to get across from a, like a branding perspective.
And I mean, are you guys using, you mentioned lockdown, are you using more digital channels to sort of get that message across? Have you found that if you are using those channels, that there's more people responding because they're generally at home and online?
Oh, it's really difficult to say, to be quite honest. Yeah. So if I think back what we were doing pre-lockdown, I mean, we're getting more attention. We get more and more attention. But I don't know if we're getting, if we hadn't have had the lockdown, whether we would be getting more than we are now, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I think every business has different channels they use, right? And everyone has you know, peaks and troughs. And, you know, I mean, I've definitely over the last few months, a few of the guests have come on and said they actually, their digital channels have been pretty good. But also, if I'm honest with you, their referral network has also been quite powerful, because it just seems to be, people just seem to be more responsive right now. So I don't know if you've seen that.
A mixture. So I'm going to say, to begin with, we had, everyone was scared of making a decision. Then it moved into everybody was interested, and then people started to make decisions. They might be more responsive, but you might not necessarily be doing more business out of it.
I mean,
the face-to-face thing for me is, you can't compare. I don't think. If you spoke to our sales guys, it's like, look, we were doing well, we're growing. but they can't wait to get in front of prospects, even existing customers, and upselling to existing customers.
No, I hear you actually on that point. I was out yesterday for the first time in a while, and I drove out to one of my clients, and I had a chat with them, and we walked through a few points. And actually today, this morning, I got a text at like 7 o'clock in the morning, a simple text saying, yeah, thanks for coming out, right? And I think you're right. The face-to-face is definitely much more powerful when it comes to building and scaling and also selling, right?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest things with selling is kind of, you know, building up the trust in your prospective customers and existing customers. Mm. And I don't know, it's a lot more believable face-to-face than it is talking to a computer screen all the time.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And yeah, as you guys are growing and you're developing your teams, I mean, how are you looking to make certain that, you know, as you move forward, your team transforms at the right pace as your business grows?
$1 million question.
They're all coming out today, mate.
Yeah. It's kind of when you look back, everything seems really easy and it's really clear. So if I just look back at what we've done in recent months. Mm. So the core team to begin with is, oh God, in a startup, it's like to an extent, everyone's a generalist. Okay, you have like somebody who looks after sales. You have somebody who looks after the kind of operations. You have someone who looks after tech. So everyone's got like a certain skill set, but largely they're generalists. Mm. You know, and it's like you've got to be like so flexible and etc. Then as you grow, and it's not just necessarily the volume, it's the type of clients, because the type of clients get more and more sophisticated and therefore they want more stuff and they need more control and stuff. Then you find that the requirement for the team is you need specialists or more specialists. So like there's a like a graph. If you were to get like the personnel, how the team, the requirements for the team, you start off with like generalists and then progressively they get more and more specialists. So you've got like the generalists, their roles might actually change a little bit and they end up being the kind of, I don't know, like joining everything together because they can do more than one thing.
Mm. No, I hear you. And are you guys going through that phase right now? Are you moving from generalist to maybe getting some more specialist type of folk in?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I can give you an example of that, like within the tech. Mm. So as we're now looking at sort of larger tickets and more, I'm going to say demanding, but rightly so, demanding kind of prospects, you know, the big name banks and stuff. Mm. They're like, look, we need this. We need like things like single sign-on. We need like certain types of APIs or whatever. So in order to build these things, it's like right now, you know, it's like, okay, we need people who are experts in that. So you hire accordingly. I mean, it might be with sales. It's like you can have like generalist salespeople or whatever. You might have a weakness in one part of the sales funnel. You know, you might not be creating enough leads, or you might not be sufficiently closing stuff, or you're lacking the sort of the resource for closing stuff. So you start looking at resource who are like specifically for like the top of the funnel lead generation, or specifically for closing, for example. Mm. And then the account management piece is like account management, customer success, or whatever label you put on it, where you've already got a customer and you've landed. It's like the whole expanding thing is, again, that's like another skill set.
So lots to consider as you build out your team, and obviously those specialist and I guess in a way niche type skills to make certain that you're always in the front foot, not just internally, but also, as you mentioned, on the account side of things, the client account side of things.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just really difficult to know how to balance as well. And you've always got, everyone was going to have this issue with the resource you've got, like how much you focus on account management, how much you focus on top of the funnel, how much do you focus on small clients, middle-sized clients, big customers with a much longer sales cycle. I think everyone will say the same thing, that you change continually those and you have to adjust. There's no like rule. What somebody says is the right balance at one point in time, at that point in time, it always changes.
Mm. So there's a requirement to be open-minded and agile to make certain that you're always pushing forward, right?
It's essential, I think. What's the expression? Continuous change. Continuous improvement. You need to continually look and review what you're actually doing. And is it appropriate right now? You know, obviously without keep chopping and changing and causing disruption. Again, there's a balance there.
That's interesting, because how do you guys do that? Is it a case of you run in on, you know, obviously you sprint and you change and you're making certain the business is moving forward, but at what point in time do you sort of stop in a way, look and review and say, okay, well, over the last, I don't know, say 3 months, this worked, this hasn't worked, let's change X, Y, Z. I mean, how often do you guys do that?
So we are extremely lucky to have a brilliant board of very experienced kind of all, they're all in the fintech field and they have sort of various, they've all been successful. So there's, I guess, well, it's a mixture between, I guess, the founders and I'm not saying who aren't successful and the guys who have been there and done it for like years and years. So we actually meet on a monthly basis and I literally provide them with information and you get an external, they're like my consultants. So the thing is, it's like you don't know everything yourself. And because you're actually living and breathing it, which is great, you've got more data points, but also you kind of become blinded because you can't look. You haven't got the view from the outside. So, I mean, the board are amazing for just kind of, they highlight things immediately. It's like, oh, I think we've got a gap here. I think we've got a gap there. So, yeah, they're great.
And outside of the board, meeting them on a monthly basis, what about, you know, the engine room, the team? Is it every week? Is it every month aligned up with how the board sort of review? How do things change there?
When I say continuous improvement or, you know, you're continually changing, I mean, it's not necessarily that radical. You know, I guess there's a bit of an 80-20 kind of rule on there. It's more tweaks than kind of radical. I mean, every now and again, you might have like a radical change. But again, I guess there's like a sliding scale. The most radical change, I guess, would be like doing a complete business pivot. But then most of what you're doing is just tweaks at the other end of the scale.
And how does, when you're moving through that change and you tweaking and you improving, you know, how do you view those, I guess, a business operational background? How do you view your systems and your processes? How do you make certain that those are sort of, I guess, maybe in sync so that it supports you guys on a continuous basis?
Yeah. So I've got a theory about this, and fortuitously, we have an ex-colleague and sort of friend of mine who's the COO who thinks very similarly. So we're always looking at the processes. One mistake I think people might make is to try and automate stuff, processes that they haven't yet really like nailed down manually. So I get our rule is when a process starts getting repeatable and we do it really well, then you start automating it. So, and pretty much everything you do, there's a decent tool on the market for it. So then we always say it's a mistake to start bringing a tool in when you don't actually have the processes that is infrequent. But then when it starts becoming kind of repeatable, when it becomes repeatable, you start enhancing it. And at that point, then we try and automate. The name of the game is to have as minimum resources possible because that's your cost.
Exactly. And how do you finance system? You're going to have a support system and, you know, processes that just flow through the business to interconnect both sales and product and dev. How have you guys thought through that to make certain you're not, to your point, you're not sort of spending money at not the right time? Do you see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah. So if we split it up into sort of tech and ops and sales, maybe.
Yeah.
So like the tech, our CTO, Dave, he's done a couple of startups beforehand and he's grown a team from zero to 30. So he knows the whole journey. He's been there and done it. And he knows the time, when to put a framework in place, you know, when to go like freestyle, when to start it's not just the check and fact. It's like when you start to do a startup, it's an art. It's just it's an art to begin with, and then you need to turn it into a science to make it scalable. So he, at certain points in time, will go, right, now we need to adopt this framework. Now we need to adopt this app or like product or whatever. And maybe this, for me, it's like honey badger. Jesus, it's like, what's that? But, you know, that's like automates like errors that come through. And, you know, and he's like, well, you know, in 6 months' time, we're probably going to need this. And then we're going to need that. So I'm probably furthest away from the actual tools that he uses. I just know the kind of names of them. And the reason I'm probably furthest away from it, because he's an absolute expert in what he does, and he's done it before. Then, of course, with the ops side of things, it's like you start off by doing everything in a spreadsheet. And then, obviously, it's like, oh, God, you know, we need a proper accounting system. So it's like, what does everyone else use? What's on the market? And then you pick one of those. And then, yeah, I guess we start running reports from intelligence, if you like it, from out of the app. You have things, without going into too much detail, intelligence on how to kind of operationally then maybe push information towards the sales team. They obviously use a CRM system. You start off by using it just like a database, and then whatever CRM system you use, they've got all of these add-ons, and like you can just progressively use it more and more efficiently.
And just to wrap up the conversation on the process and system side of things, it's important that, I guess, front to back, you have a view as to what that architecture landscape is, and making certain that both the systems and processes can actually talk to each other. Because you don't want to buy HubSpot an accounting system that doesn't integrate to HubSpot, because it's just going to be a bit of a nightmare, right? So yeah, I was just saying that that's important, along with the people side of things. So when you continuously improving, you're looking at people, process, and sort of the systems that glue your business together.
Yeah. So again, that's a difficult one to, So you have to think far enough in advance that they can actually all talk to each other. But to be really honest, it's what we do. We just make sure we're not contractually tied down too long to one thing. I mean, right now we're considering, you know, our CRM system, changing that, and you just look at the pros and cons. I think, again, it goes back to the kind of the change thing. Sometimes if you realize you're doing the wrong thing, you just need to cut it quickly and just change.
Yeah, no, exactly.
It's having the confidence to do that and not just let it drag on. And like, I think that's the main thing. You're going to get some things wrong. You know, you can't plan that far in advance.
No. Yeah, agreed. And listen, as you guys continue down that route of growth, you mentioned your board and also your team, the great team you have. What are you guys, as a senior leadership team, what questions are you asking yourselves internally, and what factors are you considering as you continue along that growth trajectory?
So you have to be really open and honest with yourself. It's like, I spoke to a VC the other day, and they said, you know, well, what do you need help in? What are you good at? What do you see your gaps are? And it's like, well, now I'm an expert in getting a company to seed stage. It's like, you know, but it's only because I've done it.
Yeah.
And you learn along the way. Is what I can't say I'm an expert in, and that's scaling a business, because I haven't done it before. So you have to be self-aware, and we all are, of what our capabilities are. You know, like, I am up to now doing everyone here is doing a reasonable job, a good job, given the positions that they've got. If we were to have like a company with 1,000 employees, like, would I be the most appropriate CEO? Would the COO be the most appropriate? Would the head of sales? It's like very unlikely that all of those, the original management team, will have the same roles when you're significantly larger. And I think if you're comfortable with that, then you probably stand more chance of actually keeping those roles. But you have to know, accept, and be flexible that whatever the best thing is for the company.
Yeah, being self-aware, that's an interesting one. And I guess as you grow, you need to make certain that, as you just mentioned, that organization of the vision is that vision of the organization in the future, you at least pushing towards that, right? So whoever the CEO is when it's 1,000. Maybe it's you, maybe it's someone else, but at least there's that vision to get there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, cool, man. And listen, I always, as entrepreneurs and startup founders, I always ask the guys and the girls what books they're reading or what podcasts they're listening to that they think would be of benefit to some of our listeners that are listening out there.
This is going to sound really, really, I'd love to say I've got, oh, I'm just reading like, you know, a really nice novel or something, but I am literally, well, I'm not literally reading because it's an audio book, The High Growth Handbook by Elad Gil that was recommended to me by a VC about scaling a business, which is amazing. It's like, it does all the right things. It's like it, equally as scary as it is exciting. But the thing is, it is what, like, it does exactly what it says on the tin. It's a handbook. You can keep going back and referring to bits and pieces. And it's great. I highly recommend it, but obviously not as a kind of, yeah, it's not, yeah, I wouldn't take it to the beach.
Yeah, maybe a train ride, although right now we're not in the trains either. Oh no, some of us are, but that sounds like awesome recommendation. Listen, mate, it's been awesome having you on the show. So I really thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. But before we sign off, how can folk out there get in touch with you and the guys?
So we're on LinkedIn, Signatize. Our website is signatize.com. my email address, I'm guesssteve@signatize.com. Get in touch. It's like, if you've got any questions or any interest or anything, it's like, it's important. We're very open.
Awesome, mate. Nice one. And looking forward to watching your success over the next few months and few years. And hopefully the book pays off. I'm sure it will.
Good investment, hopefully.
There you go. Nice one.
All right. Thanks very much for having me. Thank you.